Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Mori Yeston, two-time Tony Award-winning songwriter and lyricist, and the man behind musicals such as Nine and Titanic. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the hosts and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Hanukkah is nearly here, beginning this Thursday night, December 10th at sundown, with a very special blended celebration planned for our own congregation Beit Simcha live and on Facebook Live Saturday night, December 12th, called For Light. More about that later today, but don't miss it. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up, BeitSimchaTucson.org. I'll also be hosting a Facebook Live and Zoom presentation every night of Hanukkah at 5:30 p.m. our time, lighting a different Hanukkah menorah each night, singing the blessings, telling a story of that particular Hanukkiah. I own about 100 of them, so picking just 8 is really a challenge. These 8 nights of Hanukkah represent an opportunity to renew our commitment to Jewish identity. And an interesting key to this festival is the time of day that we celebrate, or rather the time of night. As you probably know, all Jewish holidays begin at sundown, but none are quite so night-oriented, not even Passover, as Hanukkah. Bringing light into the season of the shortest days and longest nights of the year here in the Northern Hemisphere, Hanukkah is that rare Jewish holiday in which nearly all the observances come after dark. Sure, it's still Hanukkah during the days, too, but it's the magical lighting of Chanukiyot, Hanukkah menorahs, or candelabra that we light each night of this long festival, adding one more light every night. That's the central observance of Hanukkah. We are commanded to fulfill the great mitzvah of Pirsomet HaNes, publicizing the miracle of God's redemption at this time of year in those days long ago. And nothing does that better than lights burning brightly in the windows, reminding all of us of the miraculous quality of God's redemption. Although considered a minor holiday on the Jewish religious calendar, in America, Hanukkah has become quite major. In part, this is because of its proximity to that other end of the American calendar year holiday everybody likes to celebrate. You know, Kwanzaa. But in part, it's because Hanukkah is also a festival that celebrates religious freedom, the right to worship God as we choose. Without the events we commemorated Hanukkah, the victory of a small Jewish guerrilla band led by the Maccabees over the mighty Syrian Greek army of the Seleucid Empire in the years 167 to 165 BCE, the belief in one God would have been destroyed and religious freedom eliminated. There would have been no Jews, which means no Christians, no Western civilization. For that matter, no Muslims either, since both Christianity and Islam are direct daughter descendant religions of Judaism. It's a constant reminder that religious freedom must be protected, now as in those days long ago. The story of that great revolt, catalyzed by the egotism of King Antiochus IV Epiphanes and his need not only to be obeyed but also worshipped, is an underdog narrative, how a group of Jews refused to bow down to an idol or surrender their right to study Torah and educate their children in belief in God and the moral and practical principles of Judaism, including the Shabbat. They fought, they died, but eventually they triumphed. And when they recaptured the temple in Jerusalem, they cleansed it and relit the great menorah, dedicating it anew to worship and holiness, Chanukat HaBayit. That very word, Hanukkah, means dedication. and the Jews established a Thanksgiving festival 8 days long after the military victory. It was just like the gratitude holiday of Sukkot, but in December, restoring joy and light to the temple, and nowadays to our lives at this dark time of year. So when we celebrate this week, starting Thursday night at sundown, eating anything fried in oil, especially latkes, the fabulous potato pancakes. By the way, I have a great sweet potato latke recipe. We celebrate something more than a children's festival. We are enjoying our religious freedom, which was defended and reestablished nearly 2,200 years ago by the Maccabees. And religious freedom for all religions is a great Jewish ideal worth fighting for in their day and today in ours. To play us in this morning on a slightly different tack, here's a song by our guest, Maury Yeston. His very funny and kind of true song, There's No Women in the Bible.
There's no women in the Bible. You won't find nary a one. There's no women in the Bible, just the mother or the sister of a brother or son. There's no denying the girls of Zion are hardly more than a blur. If Abraham begat Isaac, begat Jacob, you might well infer. There's no women in the Bible, you wonder where the women were. Of course, there is the special case of the first woman known as Eve. And we all know that we'd still be in the garden if we hadn't been requested to leave. Oh, Eve's fault, definitely Eve's fault. And how was Adam punished for this little episode? He had to work in the fields. No women in the Bible, you wonder where the women were.
Now pick a page, any page. If there is a woman mentioned at all in the Bible, she's standing by a well.
Yeah, with a jug.
Sarah gets the water for Abraham.
Rebecca gets the water for Isaac.
The sister of Moses puts the baby in the water.
The Pharaoh's daughter takes him out of the water. Water, 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 water. You know, thank goodness these men were thirsty.
Well, at least they mention the women who brought him a drink.
No women in the Bible. You wonder where the women were. So put women in the Bible. The time for change has begun. Put real women in the Bible. They were more than just domestics and occasional fun. Restore the brain in the girl of Canaan and don't go causing a stir. If Abraham begat Isaac, begat Jacob, there must have been.
That was No Women in the Bible by Broadway composer and lyricist Maury Yeston, our guest, in just a few moments this morning. And since we were on the subject of Hanukkah just a moment ago, don't miss the Congregation Beit Simcha Hanukkah show coming up this Saturday night. Songs, stories, guest stars singing and playing and much more. Saturday night, December 12th at 7 p.m. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org for much more about this wonderful event. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, the extraordinary Maury Yeston will share stories about becoming a Tony-winning composer and lyricist, fixing other people's shows, and how his cantor grandfather shaped his early musical inspiration, and much more. Find out all about it from Maury Yeston when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus SARS, a small group can join in person Friday night or Saturday morning or both by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Shabbat services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them on Facebook Live. It's Beit Simcha Tucson on Facebook, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. All of our services with full music are by Virtual Experience Weekly, as well as our small in-person masked and careful attendees. Our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom and also by blended format. You can access those by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is also available in blended format, some live, some on Zoom. For Hanukkah this year, beginning Thursday night, I'll be hosting a Facebook Live program at 5:30 every night, showing off one of our Hanukkah menorahs, well, mine, actually, from my collection of about 100 of them, telling its story and doing the blessings and lighting songs for you. Tune in on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. And don't miss the best Tucson Hanukkah celebration of all this Saturday night, December 12th, Congregation Beit Simcha. It's For Life, For Health, For Hope, For Light, a blended event with guest singers, stories, music, menorahs, great Hanukkah traditions, and much more. To attend on Facebook, celebrate the Festival of Lights, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or our Facebook page and sign up. If you donate at various levels, you also get great Hanukkah swag, homemade latkes, candles, a menorah, gelt, dreidels, and more, all available for contactless pickup at Beit Simcha. Don't miss For Light, For Life, For Health, For Hope, Saturday night, December 12th. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, all taught on Zoom and in blended format, and of course our services on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and most exciting and fastest growing Jewish community in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. To play in our guest this morning, here's some of a song from his own new album, Mori Sings Yestin, called The Nile Side Cotillion.
Gonna plant the family tree down in Egypt. Gonna live in Egypt like this tree. Get the cow, get the sheep, get the camel. We're gonna plant the family tree down in Egypt. Gonna live in Egypt happily. We'll have to cross a blazing hot desert and craggy peaks that blizzards fall upon. But we can do that. We're gonna plant the family tree down in Egypt. Gonna live in Egypt from now on the road, on the road,
da, 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 da.
On the road, on the road,
da, 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 da.
We're gonna plant the family tree down in Egypt, in the heart of Egypt, we will thrive. We're gonna move the family into Egypt, we're gonna be Egyptian and alive.
We are pleased and delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our quite entertaining guest this morning. Maury Yeston is a two-time Tony winner celebrating his landmark 75th birthday. He has a new double album out, Maury Sings Yeston. Maury, welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much. I should say, you know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more. Although a lot of people have been on Too Jewish for exactly that reason. Tell me, what's on the album, and why did you decide to do this now?
Well, actually, it was the idea of the progenitor and the head of PS Classics, the incredible musical theater label that has done so many wonderful things over the years, who had been one of my freshman students at Yale when I was an accidental professor there, teaching music theory. His name is Tommy Krasker. He's a brilliant guy. And, you know, when I was teaching there, I was studying in the BMI Music Theater Workshop, learning how to write musicals with Lehman Engel. And sitting next to me was Alan Menken. He had just graduated from NYU.
Nothing ever happened to him, right?
No. I was doing a PhD, and Ed Kleban was there. And so, you know, I would teach my classes and then go in every Monday and write songs. And, yeah, I hung out with the students. They were almost my age. And so if I had just written a song, you know, I might, you know, after the class play a song for, you know, one of the students. And Tommy knows everything I wrote back then. And when he graduated, that was just when we did the 9 workshop. So we gave him the job of being the rehearsal pianist. I've known him ever since. And he has known all of the demos that I have done over the years. Every time I write something, either on a home tape recorder or I go into a studio and I record it. And the reason I record it is because I like to be able to hear it as an audience member without having to sing it or hear it in my head. And, he knows since the early 1970s, all of these things that eventually ended up on Broadway or God knows where, he knows those original versions. And when I do these things, I often write very chorally, you know, for choruses and or counterpoint, and so I always do all the voices myself, and so this is affectionately known as the Maury Tabernacle Choir. So you'll hear me sing a lot of different things at the same time, and they're fascinating. Some of them are, and he said, you know, for your birthday, we want to, you know, we've got 8 albums now on PS Classics. Is we want to put out, you know, a double set of all your demos because they're so revelatory about what was the song like before it went into the show, what changed, what's different. And, you know, people often say when you hear the guy who wrote it sing it, you get a certain take on it. And so I said, all right, fine, but only because, I've taught that BMI workshop for 25 years. I've taught so many brilliant, brilliant people who ended up with Tony Awards and Pulitzer Prizes. Kid and Yorkie, and of course Bobby Lopez and Kristen, and so I put it out there because I know it should inspire young writers to persist, to know that their first version is something they're going to work on, they're going to change, and eventually, you know, it's going to be wonderful. And so for that reason, I said okay, and we've had a ball doing it.
It's so fun. They sent me the album and it's great. We will talk much more with Maury Yeston, get into some of his Jewish background, and talk about 9 and Titanic, two of his giant hits, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of 4 activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch Orkfel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail.com. or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, his very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, with over 100,000 downloads and many more from iTunes. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You started to explain quite eloquently what Nagorno-Karabakh is all about, the great flashpoint between Azerbaijan and Armenia. I mentioned that it's an enclave created by Stalin, actually, when he drew the map to include ethnic Armenians almost entirely inside Azerbaijan and create a flashpoint for conflict.
Right. And there are lots of similar flashpoints all across the former Soviet Union, and many of them have, in fact, erupted into shooting wars. The current conflict goes back to a massacre of ethnic Armenians that took place in the late 80s. Azerbaijan is a largely Muslim country, although its capital of Baku is a very cosmopolitan city that always had Greeks, Jews, Armenians, not only Azeris, not only Muslims, a very diverse, very large, actually, and prosperous Jewish community. Baku sort of blossomed after the discovery of oil not very far offshore in the Caspian Sea in the late 19th century and became the supplier of 90% of the Soviet Union's energy needs from local domestically produced oil. So Baku was a place with a lot of money floating around, and there were lots of Jewish merchants and craftsmen and tailors and whatever to take advantage of that money. In Yerevan, on the other hand, which is the capital of Armenia, there's no appreciable Jewish community at all. I mean, when I was there, there weren't even 100 Jews in this big city. And I once asked why.
Why not?
Right? Because Armenians are not particularly anti-Semitic by any means. There is an Armenian quarter, after all, in the old city of Jerusalem.
Famous. And that's where the Patriarchate is, actually.
And when I was there, the first president of independent Armenia was a guy named Levon Terpetrosyan, who had grown up in Lebanon and spoke French, which was the language he and I used, to the great dismay of note-takers on both sides. But his wife was a Jewish woman from Leningrad, and his son, David, was a Jewish guy who had a bar mitzvah. But, I mean, there really weren't more than a handful of Jews in the country, and the explanation I got was, we're the only republic in the former Soviet Union that doesn't need any Jews because we have all their skills. Brains, we're good at math, we're good at music, we're good at money, we're great craftsmen. We don't need Jews. Every other republic does.
Armenians are sort of the Jews of the area.
Right. And Armenians, like Jews, have a long history of being persecuted, being expelled, being a minority, and essentially not having their own country, not having their own nation state for many centuries. I mean, it's not an exact parallel in terms of when it began and ended, in terms of there was never a temple, but there is an autocephalous church in Armenia that has a patriarchate in its version of the Vatican, which is called Etchmiadzin. And that's a pretty impressive place. Armenia competes with Georgia for the title of the oldest Christian country in the world. In other words, the first country that converted on a national basis late in the third century of the Common Era. And you know, the two countries in some ways could not be more different, although the people look exactly the same. Armenians and Azeris, can't tell them apart from looks, but you can by language and by religion.
Well, we'll talk about Azerbaijan next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Shushi Pitzel has been nagging her husband to go with her to the seance parlor of Madame Frida. Milty, she's a real gypsy. She brings the voices of the dead from the other world. We talk to them. Last week I talked with my mother, may she rest in peace. Milty, For $40, you can talk to your Zeta you miss so much. Well, Milton Pitzel could not resist his wife's appeal. At the very next seance at Madame Frieda's seance parlor, Milty sat under the colored light at the green table, holding hands with a person on each side. All were humming, Hum, hum, hum. Madame Frieda, her eyes lost in a trance, was making passes over a crystal ball. My medium, she called, come in. Who is that with you? Who? It's Mr. Pitzel, Milton Pitzel Zede. Milty swallowed a lump in his throat and called, Zede? Zede? Ah, Miltele, a thin voice quavered. Yes, yes, cried Milty. This is your Milty. Zede, are you happy in the other world? Ah, Miltele, I'm in bliss. With your bubby together, we laugh, we sing, we gaze upon the shining face of the Lord. A dozen more questions Milty asked his Zeta. Each question his Zeta answered until the voice of his Zeta coming from the medium said, so now Milty, I must go. The angels, they are calling. Just one more question I can answer. Ask, ask. Zeta, sighed Milty, when did you learn to speak English? That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and learn to speak English. And now a word of Torah. In a change of pace and literary emphasis, Joseph becomes the principal character for the last four weekly portions in Genesis. Joseph's story is a more complete narrative than any that has preceded it. It forms a developmental transition from the short vignettes we are used to in Genesis to the long narrative of Moses that begins Exodus and occupies the rest of the Torah. The Joseph story has been called the first truly modern piece of literature, filled with contemporary authorial techniques in the delineation of character and plot. Each segment ends in a cliffhanger, and the interplay of storylines and locations makes the whole narrative vibrant, rich, and exceedingly compelling. This modernity of style is particularly impressive, since the book of Genesis was written at least 2,500 years ago. The Joseph narrative stretches through a month of Torah readings. In the weekly portions of Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, and Vayechi, we find temptation and cunning, nobility and baseness, carelessness and probity, all juxtaposed and then thoughtfully counterpointed. The foolish gain wisdom. The wicked see the error of their ways. The impulsive learn restraint. And nothing is ever quite so simple as it initially seems. It's a great story, wonderful writing about fascinating characters. Joseph himself is one of the spectacular figures in the whole Bible. Brilliant, talented, arrogant, gifted with both remarkable vision and tremendous administrative skill. He's a youth of extraordinary promise who becomes a man of fate and determination, one who survives enormous trauma to reshape two nations' intertwined destinies. A remarkably contemporary character, Joseph is a brazen, spoiled boy who transforms into a subtle, deep man. It's not an easy process, but it begins with a bang in this week's portion of Vayeshev. At the commencement of our Sedra, Jacob's beloved wife Rachel has died in childbirth, and in a pained overcompensation, Jacob spoils Rachel's oldest son, Joseph, giving him a famous coat of many colors, perhaps really an embroidered tunic, and using him as a telltale spy on his older, tougher brothers. The brothers' revenge is swift. Away from their father's eye, they capture him and sell him into slavery in Egypt, implying to their father that a wild animal has murdered him. After adventures that demonstrate Joseph's newfound virtue and his spectacularly bad luck, this week's portion ends with Joseph stuck in an Egyptian prison, his father Jacob back in Canaan mourning his supposed death, all hope seemingly lost. There are two central messages in Vayeshev. The first we've seen in Genesis earlier, but it's now reiterated poignantly. Our children are all precious. Favoring the good one does no one any good. Treat each child with love, as though in fact each of our children was truly an only child in receiving our love. That's the Jewish way to parent successfully. The second and greatest abiding message of the Joseph story is that God's plan will work, but we aren't always party to why or how long it takes. Transformation, moral and intellectual, first must occur. We struggle and sometimes suffer in order to learn what we probably should have known from the beginning, that God is the true source of good and of all understanding. For Joseph, his brothers and father, wisdom will prove to be hard won. Perhaps, in reading Vayeshev, we can learn from their mistakes and so avoid the dramatic reverses in this great story. And then we ourselves may gain the wisdom to grow and change for the better. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, the amazing Mori Yestin, shares stories of creating great musical theater out of unlikely material, becoming a Tony-winning composer and lyricist while a full-time professor at Yale, and discovering new legends in his own classes. Hear these stories and much more when we return to To Jewish in, well, just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The U.S. Supreme Court blocked government restrictions on houses of worship imposed by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in the midst of this pandemic in a ruling it made last week, deciding two cases at once, one brought by Agudas Yisrael, an umbrella organization representing Haredi, ultra-Orthodox Jews, and one brought by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn. The court ruled restrictions placed on New York's red zones with high COVID test positivity rates unfairly discriminated against houses of worship. The decision, which was split 5-4, was the first in which Justice Amy Coney Barrett, confirmed last month, gave the conservatives majority. The conservative justices were convinced by the argument that pandemic restrictions should not be stricter for religious institutions than for secular ones. It is time, past time, to make plain that while the pandemic poses many grave challenges, there is no world in which the Constitution tolerates color-coded executive edicts that reopen liquor stores and bike shops, but shutter churches, synagogues, and mosques, Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote in a concurring opinion. Both petitions were brought after parts of Brooklyn were made into red zones under a state plan implemented last month. In those zones, houses of worship are only allowed to have up to 10 people attend services at once, regardless of the capacity of the space. In orange zones, where restrictions are slightly less strict than red zones, services are capped at 25. While non-essential businesses were shuttered in red zones, those that were allowed to remain open were not subject to the same capacity limits as houses of worship. The liberal justices argued that the restrictions did not constitute religious discrimination. Chief Justice John Roberts noted it would be a significant matter to overturn restrictions meant to safeguard public health during a pandemic. Agudas Israel brought its case to the court after a federal judge in New York ruled against it. The two synagogues named in the lawsuit are no longer subject to the restrictions because their neighborhoods no longer have especially high test positivity rates, a fact two of the dissenting justices cited in their opinion. Still, the group said it was grateful for a ruling that could set a new precedent for religious liberty cases in the country. This is a historic victory, said Rabbi Chaim David Zweibel, Agudas Israel's executive vice president. The landmark decision will ensure religious practices or religious institutions will be protected from government edicts that do not treat religion with the respect demanded by the Constitution. This was not the only case where Orthodox groups have argued pandemic restrictions on worship were unconstitutional. Earlier this year, three Orthodox men and two Catholic priests sued New York officials over limitations on attendance at synagogue services imposed at the beginning of the pandemic, arguing restrictions should not be stricter for houses of worship than for other gathering places like businesses. The judge in that case blocked the state from enforcing the stricter rules on houses of worship. An Orthodox organization representing summer camps tried suing the state over its restrictions on camp this summer, also arguing the restrictions constituted religious discrimination. The judge ruled against the camp operators, saying the religious discrimination argument was not compelling. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. Play our guest back into the show. Here's a bit of his own song, December Time, a beautiful one, from his new album, Maury Sings Yeston.
Until you reach December time, your heart may lose its way. Until you reach December time, happy ending, who can say? Your life flies by in pantomime, but words require some delay. All good poetry takes time. You don't hear the final rhyme until you reach December time.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our delightful guest, Maury Yeston, just turned 75. He has a brand new album out celebrating that. He is an extremely accomplished musician, composer, lyricist, professor, although he says it's accidental, and musicologist. Among his successful Broadway musicals, writing the music and lyrics, are Nine and Titanic, both of which won him Tony Awards for Best Musical and Best Score.
Also Grand Hotel, don't forget.
And Grand Hotel, that's right, I forgot.
You know, that was our longest run. That ran over 1,000 performances on Broadway.
1,000 performances. It's amazing. So then you're rich and, you know, you can send
us a
donation.
No, I didn't get a lot. I was brought in to fix that show. So
you know, so talk about that a little bit, because although we... I remember, a quote from a famous Broadway producer and later film producer who was asked, when is a show successful? And he says, you know, how do you know? At what point in the production do you know it's going to be a hit? And he said, it's when the writer rolls over one morning and says, I've got this idea, but that's not exactly right.
Well, I prefer Jerry Robbins, who said it best. He said, Musicals are never finished. They're merely abandoned for lack of time.
You keep wanting to make it better. You keep trying to perfect it.
Well, you know, that's interesting. By the way, the name of the album is Maury Sings Yeston.
Right.
And the point of it is that from the minute you start writing something, you're always fixing it. And it never stops. And you go out of town and you're working on it and you're fixing it. And that's absolute until you know you have to freeze the show, and you know, since I've been part not only my own shows, but I've been involved in helping dear friends fix theirs. I remember, you know, and my one and only Tommy Toon was up there in Boston with Twiggy, and it was in trouble, and so I ran up there, me, Mike Nichols, and Peter Stone, the author of 1776.
Yeah.
By the way, a man actually did in London go up to the box office and say, may I please have two tickets to 1,776?
Well, it would be better if he had 1,776 tickets.
Yes, but you know, you go and you help and you fix and you advise. In the case of Grand Hotel, Grand Hotel was in trouble because Tommy Toon had devised a means of presentation in which it was all music, all dancing, all night, and Wright and Forrest, who were both in their 80s at the time. You know, they had written Song of Norway, but they had written a standard musical, and the show was in trouble. And a Toon called me up and said, I have a room for you at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel with a piano. Come save the show. And I did. I went up there, and I talked to Wright and Forrest. They're brilliant guys. And I said, God, for me to be sitting here talking to the guys who wrote, you know, so many of the great hits, And one looked at the other and said, ah, look how young he is. Doesn't he remind you of us when we first met Cole Porter?
That's great.
Well, that was worth the tank of gas to drive up. But in any case, we all got together, and I wrote about 7 songs, and the show, you know, was a smash. But you don't make a whole lot of money out of every show that you do. And frankly, you know, if I wanted to make money, I'd open up a dry cleaner. I started writing music when I was 5 years old, and I've never stopped. And I do it because I don't know what else to do, and nothing I'd ever want to do. And I think, you know, the rest of it is incidental. The reward is just in the writing.
So I want to talk a little bit about your Jewish background. You mentioned your grandfather was a chazan.
Yes, he was a part-time chazan. Right. That means that besides, you know, making a star appearance every once in a while on Yom Kippur, on the High Holy
Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur.
Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, he would take the overflow at Talmud Torah around the corner because there were too many people for the synagogue in Jersey City.
Sure.
And he was spectacular. He was just a spectacular chazan. They sent me to a yeshiva for 10 years, which is another program that we can do together. But yeah. If from the time I was carried in my grandmother's arms, you know, upstairs where the women sat, and imagine you're a 1-year-old and you're looking down and you see on a raised platform there's a man wearing a white robe and a funny hat, and he's singing at the top of his lungs, and everybody is kind of chiming in, and that's something normal.
Yep.
And if that's normal to you from the time you're before you can even speak, then it's a very small step from that to conceiving of something that's going to be on a stage and the same guy singing out to the audience. And in the same way that chazan is talking for everybody, that's what's happening on stage. And so you just take it as
that's just how it's supposed to be.
And that's why so many writers of musical theater, Irving Berlin had a grandfather who was a chazan.
Kurt Weill.
Yeah. There are at least three more. And then, of course, there's the great story when Cole Porter had not yet had a hit, and he said to Richard Rodgers, "What's your secret of writing all these hits?" And Rodgers said, "Yiddish melody." Huh. And in fact, I think that's when Cole wrote, "Oh, you'd be so nice to come home to."
It sounds like it came right off of the Second Avenue stage. Like,
I'm telling you.
That's a great story.
So I do think also that chazunish music, with that explosion of emotion that comes off, really does appear in so much of musical theater, particularly Irving Berlin. It's just this direct arrow right from a heart to another heart, and it's one of the things I love about musical theater. It's that, you know, you can talk about classical music, you can talk about all those things, but in musical theater, you know, it's like John Stuart Mill said, you know, only philosophers disagree, men have always been unanimous. It's such a fabulous, direct form that belongs to the people, and that's why I love writing it.
So, your new album, Maury Sings Yeston, here's the worst question, which song do you like best?
These are your favorites, right?
Well, you know, my grandmother, may she rest in peace, used to say, you know, how can you choose between your children? They're all like they're all fingers of the same hand. Which would you lose? But I would say a number of them I do very much like, and they mean a great deal to me. One of them, of course, New Words, because so many people have gravitated to it, and Stephen Sondheim likes to say it's his favorite song, which means a lot to me because all of his songs are my favorite songs. I would say
another nice Jewish boy, but go ahead.
Yes, indeed. I think Unusual Way is a kind of a song because, you know, I have written a cello concerto that was premiered by Yo-Yo Ma and you know, American Cantata, and I write classical music as well.
You do.
And I think that's a perfect example of everything in my musical background and personality coming out from, you know, having a common touch of just trying to write a beautiful song, but at the same time writing an accompaniment that it's influenced by my heroes like Schubert and Schumann. So it's, you know, it has a special place in my heart, but I would say that one of the things on the album reflects the variety of the things I've done. Every time I write a show, it creates a whole musical world in and of itself. You know, Nine's in Italy, and Grand Hotel is in Germany.
And Titanic is sinking.
Titanic is English,
yep,
and Goya is in Spain.
Spain, right?
And there is that on the album as well. And those people who are familiar with some of these shows on Broadway would be fascinated to see what was the original form of, let's say, the Stoker's song in Titanic. And how did it change between the first draft and the
what was actually performed on stage?
How it ended up in the show, which is really quite fascinating. And then also in the booklet, it explains why there aren't demos for certain ones. For example, there are no demos to Grand Hotel because I wrote everything in Grand Hotel in a hotel room in Boston on a piano.
Was it a grand hotel?
We had a wonderful time. We really did have a wonderful time on that show in the end, and it was really a great thrill to see a show that was so worthy and that needed a lot of help, and it was such an honor to be writing new songs for Michael Jeter, who won the Tony that year. Mm-hmm. He came out of nowhere, and the great David Carroll, who was one of the legendary tenors of the musical stage, so that was great. I wanted to mention to you there is this film called Broadway, A Jewish Legacy.
Yep,
it's a documentary.
I have, believe it or not, a DVD of it sitting in my
den. I do a section of it, and one of the things I describe is how powerfully the cantorial music affected Irving Berlin. I won't tell you now, I show you how definitively the bridge of God Bless America is influenced by the Musaf.
It's beautiful.
I'll say no more than that.
No, that's fantastic. And it's you know, look, all cantors think that American Jewish music, musical stage especially, has been highly, highly influenced by Jewish music in general. Obviously, it's true. You won 2 Tonys. You were nominated for Grammys. You've been nominated for an Academy Award. What does it mean to win an award
like that?
You know, my friend Rob Marshall said it best. You know, when you win an award is a gift. And the only response to that is when somebody gives you a gift, you say thank you.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful. Every once in a while, you know, somebody does something that you least expect, something like an Oscar nomination or God knows, a Tony Award. I mean, my very first show, Nine the Musical, was nominated against Dreamgirls, a Stephen Sondheim show, an Andrew Lloyd Webber show,
yeah.
And I had never had anything produced. And, you know, I was...
That was your first shot, right?
My first shot, and we just won everything. And it was... You know, it was at the time I was a full-time professor at Yale and the director of undergraduate studies in music there, and it was such an exciting thing to happen. As a matter of fact, that very night I received a telegram from one of my former students just after I had won the Tony, and the telegram said, "Those who teach can."
That's fantastic. Is that... I mean, that's your first. Do you ever, like, isn't that kind of still your favorite to some degree? I don't know why I'm pushing you in this direction, but I am.
Every show completely reinvents the form. There's just no boilerplate version of a musical.
There used to be to a degree, right?
There was a formulaic, but you know, not anymore. You know, I can remember teaching BMI and Bobby Lopez and Jeff Marks were in. There were students there,
right.
And they were writing a thing called Avenue Q.
Yep.
And I'm looking over my shoulder, and there's 4 actors there sitting there with puppets. And I'm saying to myself,
"What is going on here?
$350 a ticket for puppets on Broadway."
Yep.
But then they came in with Fine Fine Line, which is just a world class pop ballad.
That's
and
a
I
gorgeous
thought,
song.
This is going to be gorgeous. And again, you know, there's Kid and Yorkie, and they're writing a show in that in my class called Feeling Electric, and it's about this woman, and she's got mental problems, and she's getting, you know, sort of electroshock therapy, And when they went into development for it, their director said to them, look, guys, you have to decide, are you going to write a show about a treatment, or are you going to write a show about a family? And they ended up with Next to Normal, which
right.
won them a Pulitzer Prize. And so, again, the great thing about musicals is that it's terra incognita. You just have to be open to the idea that you're coming up with an idea that's just that sounds ridiculous, but of course musicals should sound ridiculous because you know are you going to write a show based on a surrealistic Fellini movie that nobody understands, or the worst maritime disaster in history, or a mass murderer who's a barber,
and they're all great shows. Two of them are yours.
Landing in Vietnam.
Yep.
But the thing is that that's the best. When you write something and you think, oh, everybody's going to know about this, well then they come in and they say, show me. But if you write something that knocks people off their chairs and they say, holy cow, I didn't think they could would be able to do this. Peter Stone likes to say, you want them to hear that you're in trouble out of town. It lowers expectations. And then you come in and they say, well, I hear they're working on it, and the show gets better and better. And that's a much better way to bring a show in than to have glowing reviews from out of town and then all these tough-minded New Yorkers sit there and say, okay.
Not that good.
Yeah.
Maury, I want to thank you for a fantastic visit. We are well past our time, and it was well worth it.
Well, it's wonderful to chat with you.
The album is called Maury Sings Yeston. Where can people go to find out more about you?
You can download it from Spotify, Shmodify,
right.
Amazon, and all that stuff, and there's even going to be CDs that you can buy.
There still are a few people that play them. Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our play out this morning comes for the upcoming holiday of Hanukkah starting Thursday night. Sam Glazer's new version, Hanukkah, Oh Hanukkah. Don't miss For Life, For Health, For Hope, a celebration of light. Congregation Beit Simcha's big Hanukkah event this very Saturday night, December 12th. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information or go to our Facebook page to sign up. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Rabbi Mark Diamond, co-editor of the first book ever co-published by Jewish and Latter-day Saints publishers on Jewish and Mormon themes, covenants, and communities. My friends, may you have a wonderful start to the great holiday of Hanukkah, Thursday night at sundown for 8 crazy nights, and have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of health and peace.
Tashenu begilu v'simcha memalim et libenu la'alavayom zvivonenu yisov suvganiyot nochal bablarov we
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.